Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Madeline Ashby. Madeline is a futurist and science fiction writer living in Toronto. Her most recent novel, Company Town, is available from Tor Books. Hey, Madeline, welcome back.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So Madeline, you've got a set of interesting tools here for us, and why don't we just go ahead and jump right into it, and then a little after that we can talk about a podcast that you have. But tell us about the Eddie Bauer Travax line.
Okay, well, the last time I was here, I talked to you about the another Eddie Bauer product. I find that as you get older, you sort of turn into your parents. And for me, that means wearing a lot of Eddie Bauer. I grew up outside of Seattle, and everyone there wore Eddie Bauer because it was a local company and stuff. So I got sort of inured to the brand at the time. And at the time, I thought it was like desperately uncool, right? Now, I live in an area that frequently goes below freezing and has freezing rain. I live in Toronto. So I now wear a lot more Eddie Bauer than I ever thought I would. And for me, I travel a great deal. And last time I was here, I talked about things that I use while traveling. And this is another side of that. The Travax line from Eddie Bauer is sort of a wash and wear line that is designed to, for men and women, that is designed to be packable, light, breathable, moisture wicking, and to be designed to be, you know, able to be washed in a sink and hung up in a hotel shower or in an Airbnb shower or what have you, and then worn the next day. So if you buy sort of pieces from the Travax line, things get a lot easier to pack. They come in sort of really basic colors like black, blue, gray, things like that. There's everything from leggings to dresses to trousers to there's even a Travax flannel jacket, which I'm really interested in but don't have. Mm-hmm. And so on. And what I've found, I wear these a lot. They're extremely comfortable. They're extremely wearable. They're extremely packable. Every time I wear a piece from the collection, someone compliments me, which I love, obviously. Mm-hmm. But what I really noticed was recently my husband was in the hospital. He had 3 surgeries in 1 month. He related to a bacterial infection that got into the gallbladder that became sepsis.
And I hope he's okay now.
He is. Yes. Thank goodness. Good. And thank you to the Canadian healthcare system. without which we would be bankrupt. While I was there, every travel habit that I had while I was going back and forth between the hospital and my own home sort of came in useful. I realized that I had to pack every day for the hospital in a sort of hospital-based everyday carry in the same way that I would if I were traveling for work. And I had to wear clothes that were very similar to if I were flying, because you're really just sitting there, you know, sort of waiting for the latest bit of news from a surgeon or from a nurse or what have you. And you're trying to be there, you're trying to be supportive and trying to also, you know, trying to get work done in vain. It's impossible to work in a hospital unless you are paid to work in a hospital. But what I noticed was that I wore more of this line there than I did almost when I'm traveling. So I think that it's a line that's pretty affordable. It's a line that is really comfortable, really easy to wear. Everything matches. And it's really useful in a lot of odd circumstances in life, not just travel.
Cool. I'm looking at it right now. So they have a variety of different leisure wear, casual wear things, from long sleeve t-shirts, which I wear, to, as you say, flannels, Oxford-like shirts. I'm looking at the men's guys, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
And so this is made to, as you say, to be hand washed if you are on the road and easily rolled up, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
In luggage.
Or put into packing cubes or something like that. Yeah. It doesn't wrinkle. It just sort of lies flat again. And it's really comfortable for like long, I've worn it on long train trips, long flights. And it, you just walk off the plane looking none the worse for wear.
Great.
And what about, I like those ones where you can convert them from long pants to shorts with the zipper.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The convertible, I don't have a pair of those, but I kind of want them because cool. There are definitely times, especially out here in the summers, we have really nasty black flies and mosquitoes and so on. And if you're at all outdoors in the summer here in Ontario, you go from wanting to wear shorts during the day to wanting to cover every possible inch of skin at night.
Yeah,
when the bugs come out.
Oh man. I bet.
We also have Lyme disease here, so it's it's a real security measure.
Scary.
Yeah. It's not great. Not fun.
Yeah. So you have a sunscreen that you recommend.
Yes. Everyone should wear more sunscreen. Mm-hmm. If that was your New Year's resolution this year, was to take better care of your skin or just avoid skin cancer, I have the sunscreen that, you know, my incredibly pasty, oily skin loves. And it's like the most, it's the, I don't know, like the Irish friendly skin. I don't know, the Irish friendly sunscreen. I don't know. But I really love it. And I'm going to try to pronounce this name correctly. It's Lancôme Bienfait or mm-hmm. Bienfait UV SPF 50. It's an SPF 50, which is sort of what you want. It's a broad spectrum sunscreen. There are chemical ingredients as well as physical sunscreen ingredients within it. But it's a liquid, which means that unlike a lot of sunscreens, which are really creamy or heavy or oily or kind of sticky and tacky and make your skin kind of feel weird or make you feel kind of gross, this is a liquid. It just sort of, you shake it vigorously. It pours out into your hand like a liquid, or like it's water-based. And because it's water-based or because it's a liquid, it absorbs into your skin really quickly. You don't have to stand there sort of rubbing and rubbing and rubbing trying to get this into your skin. And because it's designed for, because it's made by Lancôme, really, it just sinks right into the face and doesn't cause breakouts and doesn't feel sticky or weird. And in fact, I will tell you this, this is not a consideration for everybody or for all of the listeners, but if you wear makeup of any kind, it works beautifully under makeup and works like a primer, which you might be about to ask me about primer.
Yeah, so that was my next question.
So primer is a, when we talk about primer in the context of skincare or cosmetics, what we mean is a layer of product that exists between moisturizer and makeup. So like when we're painting a room, we sometimes prime a wall before we paint it, mm-hmm. right? We paint primer over it so that whatever paint lies on the surface will lie more flat and more smooth and will look more even.
I've heard the term foundation.
Right, exactly. Yes. So foundation makeup usually sits better over primer.
So wait. So the layers go skin, primer, foundation, moisturizer, cosmetic?
No. It goes skin, moisturizer. Well, if you wanted to be really technical, it would be skin, serum, moisturizer, primer. It might be skin, serum, moisturizer, sunscreen, primer, foundation. This is the paint tax at work.
And then on top of that is the cosmetic itself.
And then there's pigmentation. Yeah, there's whatever pigments you want to apply and stuff. We could do – that would be like a whole other – I'm sure that there are podcasts that are cool tools for cosmetics. But when I found this sunscreen – I started telling everyone about it. I was like, I found it. I found the one. And mostly because It works really well. I've gone out in the sun wearing it. I've brought it traveling with me to sunny locations. I was just in October, I was in Palos Verdes and wore it every day. Was standing outside on in the sun during the afternoon, had no ill effects. It was a real surprise. But that's, and I only had to apply it once a day. Which really says a lot.
There's a little bit, like if you put a few drops in your, how much do you need? I guess what I'm trying to say is 1.7 ounces is $40. So it's expensive.
Yes.
Is that?
Yes. But it goes a long way because it's a liquid. So I would say maybe the size of, maybe slightly smaller than the size of a dime,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Does that make sense? Sure.
And then just over your face and neck, like trying to get every place where, like the top of your forehead, the tip mm-hmm. of your nose, anywhere that like you know the sun is really, really going to hit
right.
you.
Right. So it's face only. You wouldn't slather this over your entire body when you go to the beach.
I mean, if you had the cash, uh-huh. you can. I mean, I would if I could. But actually, there's a debate about whether or not, like, you know, dermatologists and actually oncologists sort of debate about like what types of sunscreen are the best and how to label sunscreen accurately. And actually different countries have different standards for sunscreen and what's allowed to be in them. And so there's also a debate, in skin cancer communities about like how best to apply sunscreen, what types to use, and whether or not spray is better than liquid or cream or physical sunscreen is better than chemical sunscreen, and the environmental damage that wearing chemical sunscreen does to things like coral reefs, things like that. So it is, you might be better off with a different mechanism for the full body mm-hmm. is what I'm saying.
Okay. Okay. Well that's great to know. Sounds like good, precious stuff.
Hoard it. Yes. Hoard it is what I'm telling you.
Yes.
Hoard it.
So next thing on your list is a planner. I'm always interested
yes.
in that kind of thing. So tell us about this one and why you like it.
This is the Productivity Planner from Intelligent Change, and it's a company that makes only a handful of planners. One is the Productivity Planner, and what I really like about the Productivity Planner is that it is a it allows for a weekly format as well as a daily format. It's unnumbered. You number it yourself. You add the dates yourself. But at the
we may want to take a minute to explain to the young people what a planner is.
Well, this is a paper planner. I feel like this because I know a lot of younger people. Like a lot of my students are aware of things like bullet journaling. So if you're in between the space of knowing that you want something more than an app, or if all the apps that you've tried for to-do lists and what have you aren't working, or you're not paying attention to them, or you're sick of notifications, or you don't feel that you enjoy them, you might want a paper planner. Also, you just might want a paper planner for security reasons. If you
what
have
these look like they're like little books.
Yes, they are little. Like, they are little books.
They're bunches of paper bound in the book with a cover, and you do your planning ahead of schedule with pen in this book.
Yes, much like bullet journaling, which is insanely popular. But I tried bullet journaling, and I have other friends who tried bullet journaling, and I tried that, and I tried the whole like different colors for things and washi tape and like all these different like stickers and all kinds of things like that. And I found that creating the system took more time than accomplishing the task.
Yeah, that can happen.
And I think, yeah. And as you're, you know, essentially when you design a bullet journal, you're creating a UI, you're creating a user interface for yourself. Out of pen and paper and washi tape and stickers and who knows what. What I like about the Productivity Planner is that it streamlines some of that work for you. And it asks you a really important question. Right at the beginning of the planner, they sort of explain their philosophy. And this really changed how I thought about getting things done. Because what they explain is your topmost task or the most important task of the day, which is how it's labeled at the top of every page, they ask beneath it, if this was the only thing you did today, you'd be satisfied. So if you only did one thing today, if you only accomplished one thing today, you might work on other stuff, but if you only accomplished one thing today or one piece of a goal today, what would it be to satisfy you? And crucially, when they talk about how to find that out for your day, how to prioritize your tasks, they ask you at the beginning of the book, what is the task, what is the thing that you are most afraid of doing today? Because the thing that the thing that you are most likely to avoid is probably the thing you need to do most. But it's also the thing that's probably holding you back. You might be sort of procrastinating by doing a bunch of other tasks around this task. Like the sort of procrasti cooking, procrasti cleaning, procrasti emailing, procrasti social media.
I've never heard of those terms, but I
yeah, but it's talking about whatever you do, all the little tasks around the thing that you really know you should do, which is write 2,000 words or clean the gutters or make that phone call that you have been dreading or what have you. So they ask you to say, like, what is the thing that you're afraid of doing? Do that first, and then everything else will follow. And they base this on sort of on willpower studies that, you know, are sort of, I think they're up for debate, but their philosophy is basically, if you do the thing that you're scared of right away, you will go into the day with more confidence generally. And I've found that to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, that's the sort of 200 words a day that a lot of other authors or 500 words.
Yeah.
They do them in the morning, and then it's like the rest of the day is a bonus.
I can
and whatever happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything
right.
else is a gift.
You know, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And so when I've been really dithering or I really can't figure out how to prioritize stuff. And I think that everybody who works in sort of creative fields or any kind of freelancer where you're working like three different tasks at a time or three different jobs at a time, the half of it is prioritization. And if you have, what I find is asking yourself what you're really scared to do or what you have been avoiding is a good way to find out what you really, really need to do.
And so this book, this planner book, mm-hmm. would have like a year's worth of
I think it's six
pages,
months.
Or how
I
is
think
it?
It's six, 6 months. Months. If okay. you, and that assumes that you use it every week. I mean, you might be taking weeks off. You might not write in it for a week. If you're traveling, it's less useful. If you are if you're on vacation or you're not using it, or you know flat out what you're going to be doing. So if you're facilitating a week-long workshop or something like that, you're probably not going to use it in the same way that you would if you were in your own office planning out other tasks. There have been times when I've used it off and on, but when I need to sort of recenter myself, I've found it really, really useful.
Cool. Yeah, I see looking at it, it is kind of full of questions, self-evaluation. So it's more than just a place to put things. It's slightly interactive in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It asks you to give yourself a productivity score at the end of the day. It asks for notes at the end of each day. It also works on a Pomodoro system. Sometimes you can use it that way. There are sort of little squares and circles to estimate how long you think a task might take and to gauge your estimate against the actual time that something took. So if you want to get really granular, you can.
Yeah, that's interesting, that the Pomodoro technique, and I've been experimenting with that. Seems like a pretty good way to like stick to a project and keep your focus.
I think so. I've found it really useful. There are different like Chrome and Firefox extensions that allow you to do that. That I think both are called Marinara, which are sort of extensions that allow you to work in bursts or that encourage you to work in bursts and appear as sort of browser notifications, telling you to sort of put your head down for 20 or 25 minutes and do this task, then take a 5 minute break and do that five times. And then at the end, you get a longer break. And for a lot of people, I know that really works. I have a friend who writes in Pomodoros and she just adores it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. You can do almost anything for 20 minutes.
Right. Exactly.
yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's true. Yeah. So you have a couple other items for us too.
Yeah. So this is the Sabatier 200 10-inch knife, and it is probably the best knife that we have ever owned in our household. This is actually sort of my husband telling you about this, because when he first purchased this knife, he would not stop talking about it. He could not stop talking about it. He kept demonstrating it. Like, he would hold sheets of paper out and slice paper with this knife. He sharpens it obsessively. Like, I'm making him sound really creepy right now, and I understand that, but really it's about the knife, I swear.
and this is, for everyone's edification, this is a chef knife that we're talking about.
Yes, it's a 10-inch chef knife, yes.
It's in a kitchen, rather than the everyday carry knives that some of the guys seem to like, or the survival knife. This is the 10-inch chef knife for cutting veggies and things.
Yeah, it goes really well with vegetables. It also slices through meat and fish really well. But crucially, there are a few really interesting things about this knife. One is that it comes from a family business that has existed in France since for the past 200 years. There are 8 generations of this family that have made this same knife. And it's also made with the thinnest and lightest steel that they could find. It's loaded with nitrogen. They use cryogenic tempering to get the hardness of it. It has an ultra-fine grind. And it is the lightest knife I have ever used.
Wow.
It feels dangerously light in your hand. It's like it whispers through herbs and through vegetables. Suddenly it's like they disappear under the chopping edge of this thing. It's so light that you almost feel like you almost have to retrain yourself in how to use it. But it means that the cuts can be very fine and that you can break down things a lot more quickly. It's not like a big, heavy santoku knife or a big cleaver or a dollar knife, obviously, that requires a lot of extra brute force. You don't have to exert sort of extra foot-pounds of pressure to get through things. It's so light and really so sharp that... It's just amazing. And it does slice through paper.
And to put it in context, it's listed here on the website that I'm looking at as 157 euros.
Yes.
Whatever that translates into dollars these days.
You don't want to know what it means in Canadian dollars. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it's $180 or something.
It's the price of a small country.
And I guess, does that mean it's imported? England?
Yeah, you can find probably a local knife shop would know about it. One of the men who helped design the latest edition of this knife actually works out of Toronto, and he worked with the Sabatier family to help build this knife. He's known locally as Greg the Knife Guy, because Toronto is apparently an incredibly small town. But there's actually sort of a weird little knife district in Toronto where you can find artisanal knife shops, and which I recognize sounds like the most hipster thing ever, but it's there. And there are a few places. There's Greg's shop. There are a couple of different Japanese knife stores, and you can sort of go around and find the one that really works for you. Since we use this one, we almost don't use the others. Like we have other knives in our collection. We still use our cleaver. We still use paring knives. We still use, we have a couple of other chef's knives, but really this is the one. And it requires extra care. But my husband has found that that's sort of been a really meditative activity for him.
Sharpening the knife.
Yeah, he's really gotten into like the fine grains of like Japanese water stones and the sort of the angles of sharpening and like when you should take it in to be sharpened versus what you can do to sharpen it yourself and the different kinds of effects that you can create. And he's really enjoyed it. And also it just does beautiful work.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. In our household too, we have a favorite knife, and it's like you open up the drawer of knives, and it's like your hand automatically goes, it's going to reach for that one. Your brain's not thinking; it just wants that knife.
Well, and I think
it's kind of calling out to you.
Yeah, well, that's how you know good design, right? You know, you might have something else in your drawer in your house that's prettier, or more trendy or what have you. But when it comes to working with your hands know what they want. They know what's easiest to use. And your if something is well designed, it's almost invisible, right? But if it's well designed, it's so easy to use that your body instantly remembers how to use it. And will recall and will start to prefer using that thing over other devices. And so that sort of came to be the case for us, that it's a knife that it's listed on the website as 170 grams, which is so light that you can balance it on your finger. And it just mows through everything we give to it. It's not as good on bone. I would not use it to cut through a big bone-in piece of meat. But for taking meat off of the bone, or for mowing through vegetables, or mowing through herbs, or mowing just sort of even like odd little things, tissues or like something like that, something that you might think is difficult to slice. I would highly recommend it. and the brand in general.
Well, it sounds like it. Yeah. I'd like to,
good to know.
Definitely like to try it out.
That's on my wish list now.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Tell us about what you're working on these days, and what's coming up, and what you're excited by in terms of your own work.
So my friend and colleague Scott Smith and I, who's another futurist, and we work together fairly frequently, we kind of finally succumbed to the external pressure to do a podcast. And this was a thing that we'd been encouraged to do it by people who knew us, who probably just wanted us to sort of, you know, shut up and let them talk for a change. But we also noticed in our experience that we were frequently sort of asked as a group, or within the context of our work, to be in conversation together. So recently we did last year we did an event with ASOS, the fast fashion brand out in England, and they sort of had us on stage for 6 hours talking about different topics about the future of retail. And we each brought different points of view to the table, and we realized that like we really had a fun experience there, and that we could really do this about other topics that aren't necessarily covered in the traditional sort of tech solutionist, the tech-centric or solutionist way of thinking about things. So in the traditional technology press, because as futurists, one of the things that we do is constantly gather information. We are constantly glued to the screen, or sort of immersed in the stream of information. And it's really easy to pick out big stories. Like this time of year, if you go to any consultancy or any technology publication, there will usually be like some sort of like major upcoming trends of 2019 or the biggest tech stories in 2018. And you'll find those. You can also go to a big consultancy and find like the trends that they think are the most important for the next year or the next 5 years. And we understood that, you know, those are easy to find. And what's harder to find are the sort of little niche stories that people might be taking for granted, or that aren't discussed as much because they're too tricky or too complicated or too sticky or too scary or what have you. And so we decided to put together Underfutures. And Underfutures, which you can find at anchor.fm/underfutures, and which is available on all major platforms like SoundCloud, Spotify, iTunes, all of them, sort of talks about that. And we spend half hour to a 45 minutes talking about, you know, our perspective on those, on the things that aren't getting talked about in the future, and the futures of those things, the many futures of those things, the many possible futures of those things.
And how many episodes so far?
We've done the one. We're sort of planning up the rest of the schedule. We're aiming for once a month. At one point, mm-hmm. we thought we would do once a week and realized that there was just literally no time. We couldn't do it. So we didn't want to overpromise. But I think also deciding on one theme a month allows us to really find all the latest research on a niche that people aren't necessarily talking about. So the most recent, the inaugural show was on the future of citizenship, or the many futures of citizenship. Mm. And so we got to talk about things like e-residency in Estonia, or platform citizenship, or sort of just the futures of technology that, you know, the futures of identity technology, and things mm-hmm. like that. And it really, you know, once we got going, it was almost, we had to prune out what, you know, other stuff. so there's, there's a lot to talk about, you know.
That sounds terrific.
Yeah.
I hope so. I hope people enjoy it. I really hope people enjoy it, because I love doing it, and I really hope that other people enjoy it.
No, yeah, you've picked some great, I mean, that's a great, that first one is just a great topic in itself, very deep, can go many ways. It's not going away. You know,
right, exactly. And so many of these things, I think there's a real temptation when we talk about, you know, the future of a given thing, and we treat it like a problem to solve rather than a circumstance we have to live with, or the way that we live now. And that when we examine something sort of one thing sort of more in depth, you can sort of get into the many possible futures of that thing in many possible areas. Citizenship looks very different in different countries or on different platforms. And you can't say the future of any given topic. You have to talk about the futures, including what we would consider the under futures, the stuff that isn't really immediately apparent.
I like that. It sounds like essential listening for me in my role at Institute for the Future.
Absolutely,
as a researcher, too.
Well, we would hope so. We would hope so. We would hope you enjoy.
Yeah, I'm sure I will. Well, I've actually had you consult for Institute for the Future.
I have,
so
yes.
Yeah.
Which was a delight, I might add.
Oh, good. Good. Well, expect me to contact you again about more
on the,
of this
on the futures of the citizenship.
Yeah. Let us know. So Madeline, I love California.
Great. Madeline, it was great to have you join us again.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope that some of this is useful to the people.
As always, yes. Very much so. And in fact, if you ever need to change your job occupation to make a great saleswoman.
it's funny you should say that, because that's what my dad does. My dad has been in sales basically my whole life.
You sold me on that knife. It's like, oh my gosh, I have to get that knife now.
I know. It's suddenly become essential.
Wait, what have I been doing without this in my life? Oh, man.
Yeah, wait, exactly. There's more.
It slices. It dices, literally.
Well, thanks so much, Madeline. And I hope to have you on again very soon.
That would be lovely. Thank you so much.